All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's our turn. And boy, it's been a couple of weeks, hasn't it? Glad to be here to talk with you live and lively. That the place is the marketplace of ideas, Chris, for stand a reason. And sorry, I was distracted there for a moment. This, as I said, is the marketplace of ideas where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the open forum of talk radio. And I am very interested in talking with you, actually, more personally, the second hour together, because I have a guest with me the first hour. Now, I know that I've been gone here for a couple of weeks. I was out on Easter, and last time I was with you was Palm Sunday. And then I was out of town, actually, last weekend I was at Berkeley. And I want to talk to you about that. That was quite an experience. I had two lectures on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley, and that was the first time I'd been back on campus in 32 years. The last time I was there was when I was a hippie walking the streets of Telegraph Avenue there at Cal, and it was great to be back there and to see the response. But I'm going to get into that in our second hour as I bring you up to date to what's been happening. Actually, since I talked to you, I think I've been on three campuses and lots to talk about. His book, because as I went through this week, this turns out of the I consider it one of the fine primers in Christian defenses. And there's a number of books that are kind of like this, that is, that they serve as an excellent primer. And this is certainly one of the best. It is co-authored by Norm Geisler and Frank Turek. Frank is the vice president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. He's appeared on many TV shows. In fact, I'm interested in talking to him about Hannity and Combs and the O'Reilly Factor and Politically Incorrect. He's also the co-author of Legislating Morality, Is It Wise? Is It Legal? Is It Possible? And that won the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association's Gold Medallion Award as the best book in its category. He's got two master's degrees and is currently working on a PhD at Southern Evangelical Seminary. He's a pretty smart guy, and he's a pretty nice guy, too. Frank, welcome to the show. I need Frank there. Hello? Hold on, Frank. It's not your fault. There you go, Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
Welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing just great. What an introduction. Man, I should just hang up now. Everything's downhill after that.
Yeah, you see, it's like I want to hear this guy. I don't want to be this guy, you know. Yeah, well, you've really made a great impact, and your work is actually a little bit new to me, to be honest with you. You sent me the other book, but I didn't read it. It was so much like my own book, I thought I'd be reading the same stuff or something similar. But I have gone over I Don't Have Enough Faith to be an atheist, and I'm very excited about this book. I got to tell you a story, by the way.
Go ahead.
3 days ago, I was sitting in the dentist chair, and I'm just getting ready to get my teeth cleaned, and my dentist walks over, pardon me, and he says, "Have you seen this book yet?" And he plops your book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, right in my lap. And I said, "Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm reading it right now, and I'm talking with Frank Turek, one of the authors, on the weekend." And he said, "This is the greatest thing I've ever read." Now, I know he's read my book, too, on relativism. So, you know, I figured that must be high.
That's
high.
Second best.
No, that's high praise.
I'm going to tell you a quick story. I don't know if you know this, but last Monday night, it was about 26,000 in rank on Amazon. And then David Limbaugh, who wrote the foreword for our book, he's Rush's brother, as you know, wrote an article that he posted on his website, and it's posted around the internet.
I see it from townhall.com. Does atheism require more faith? I see it right
exactly.
Here, April 20th.
Well, in any event, he posted about 9:30 on Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I went to bed about 11 o'clock, it was already down to about 4,000. I said, "Man, this guy has some pull." I woke up the next morning, it was around 600.
No
went
kidding.
To breakfast. I came back, it was 197th.
Well, that's great.
Then it was 97th. Then it was 69th. Not that I was watching it, Greg.
Yeah, no.
not that I was obsessed with it or anything. It went, Greg, it went all the way to number 12 on Amazon in ranking because of David Limbaugh's article.
Mm-hmm.
Right now it's about 250th or so. But
well, it's nice to get that, you know, some free publicity like that. But your book should get that, and I hope it gets a lot more attention. Because here it is, a significant volume. We got nearly 450 pages, if you count the fine print in the back. And it covers a lot of different material. Now, the title is engaging. It says, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Now, the word faith is equivocal there. You're going to play on words. Why don't you explain that to us?
Well, the point that we were trying to make with the book, my co-author, Dr. Norman Geisler, has been saying that for years. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist.
Right.
And I said, you know, that'd be a great title for our book. And the sense we're using it in is this. You either have evidence for what you believe or you have faith. The more evidence you have, the less faith you need. The less evidence you have, the more faith you need. And due to the fact that there is just so much evidence for the Christian worldview, we think you have to have a lot more faith to believe anything other than Christianity, including atheism, including any non-Christian worldview. So that's why we took that title.
That would be taking, in a sense, the secular world's definition of faith being a leap of faith or blind faith. And if, as you pointed out, faith is at the opposite end of the spectrum with evidence and knowledge, then the evidence and knowledge, as you argue here, go with the Christian point of view, the Christian faith, and the leap of faith goes, ironically, with the other guys, not with us.
Exactly, and that's kind of counterintuitive, and that's why we picked the title, and we really think that it does take a lot more faith to be a non-Christian than it does to be a Christian.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you do develop the point that genuine biblical faith, pists in the New Testament, this is a trust that really goes with the evidence, and it's
not meant
to be a blind leap.
Absolutely, and we think what we point out in the book, as you know, is that we think Christianity is true beyond a reasonable doubt. Is it true beyond any doubt? No. I got to be honest with you, it's not true beyond any doubt. We could be wrong about this, and I know you've said that many times.
Of course.
In fact, when I've seen you present, Greg, you say, "Hey, you know, I could be wrong about this."
Absolutely, I say it all the time.
Yeah, and
some Christians get upset about that, by the way, because they think you're not expressing confidence in your view. And I told one woman, I said, "Ma'am, nobody has ever accused me of not being confident in my view."
Right.
But I'm not God, after all, so we could be mistaken on this.
Right, but I really think it takes more faith to be an atheist than does to be a Christian. And in fact, more faith to be a non-Christian than does to be a Christian. What we do, Norm Geisler and I have been traveling the country for about the past 8 or 10 years doing a seminar we called The 12 Points to Show Christianity is True.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that's what this book is. It's an argument from the ground up for Christianity, from the question of truth all the way to the Bible is the Word of God. And the way we do that is we start with truth, then we talk about the evidence for God, then we talk about the evidence for miracles, the New Testament, the fact that Jesus died and rose from the dead, and from there obviously you get right to the Bible being the Word of God.
Mm-hmm. You don't even start with any assumptions at all. You start with doubt almost. You start with people who even reject the notion of any truth at all. So you're beginning right where they're beginning, as it were.
In the postmodern world.
Yes, of course. Now, have you found that the postmodern world has represented a significant obstacle to you in communicating the faith?
Well, I don't think so, because just like you're good at doing, it's very easy to skewer that particular worldview.
Mm-hmm.
As we say in the book, I've heard people on the radio call in to a radio host and say, "Hey, there is no such thing as truth." And the easiest way, as you know, to answer that is just say, "Is that true?"
Right, right.
I mean, they're making a truth claim.
Right.
And we call it the roadrunner tactic in our book. I think you call it the Columbo tactic.
No, we call it the suicide tactic.
Oh, suicide
if you're
tactic,
talking about the notion that a view is self-refuting.
Yeah.
The Columbo tactic is using questions to sometimes exploit a self-refuting argument.
Right, okay,
you're
right.
You can use them together, but
We call it the roadrunner tactic because it always reminds me of Wile E. Coyote trying to catch the roadrunner.
Yeah.
You know, the roadrunner stopping short of the cliff, and then Wile E. Coyote zooms past him and is hanging midair for a minute with that question mark over his head.
Boing!
Yeah. You know, that's sort of what you do when you catch somebody in a self-defeating statement. You stop short, they blow right by you, and they have no ground to stand on. They fall into the valley in a heap.
Now, how is it that people respond, though, when you offer some of these arguments, as you just noted here, to postmoderns? Because we are dealing with a lot of people who have bought this radical skepticism, this radical relativism, that essentially can be cashed out in an unsophisticated way with the statement there is no truth. I mean, it's more sophisticated than that, but I think this captures the point.
Sure.
There is no objective reality to discover. We are caught behind our conventions, our language, our sense datum, whatever, and we construct our own reality. And so everybody's got a different reality.
Well,
so go ahead.
We just point that out that, you know, obviously that's not true. I mean, we don't create our own gravity, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because you don't believe in gravity and you don't think you can sense gravity, it's still holding you down just like it's holding me down, whether I believe in it or not.
Or bringing you down if you step off the roof of a building, you know.
Exactly. In fact, David Limbaugh in his foreword says, you know, anyone who denies this, why don't you just ask him to go to the tallest building in town and take a leap off?
Yeah.
You
know? There you go.
I mean, there are truths about the moral world just like there are truths about the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
and they're just as unforgiving.
Mm-hmm. What do you so when you start with the foundation with the issue of truth? Of course, the argument you just gave is it seems clear that there are some truths that we can know, and even those who have to deny that there are truths are stating a truth in the process. So this is self-defeating. So you begin to lay a foundation. You actually do a nice job, I think, in dealing with a little bit with Immanuel Kant and David Hume and some of the skepticism that they introduced into the philosophic world that has borne fruit here in the 20th and the 21st century. You want to talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, well, I'm amazed. Actually, I'm not amazed because I didn't really know about Kant or Hume until I came to seminary. But their worldview, or their views, have really permeated our culture. As you know, Hume was pretty much the one who said you couldn't believe in miracles and you could only believe in something if it was empirically verifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the problem with his view that you can only believe in something if it's empirically verifiable or it's true by definition. Well, that particular statement that mm-hmm. you can only believe in something if it's empirically verifiable or true by definition is not. You can't prove it by empirical verification. It's mm-hmm. not true by definition. So the statement defeats itself. It's the suicide tactic.
Sure. I don't understand, Frank, why it is that so many brilliant people walk into these problems. You have all kinds of points of view that make these similar kinds of claims, yet their claims can't even justify or substantiate themselves, and so they become obviously self-refuting. You'd think these people would know better.
Yeah, I know, and you know, Kant the same way. Kant, of course, said the easy way to remember Kant is he said you can't know the real world.
Right.
You know, you can only know the phenomena that your brain forms, the sense data that your brain forms. Mm-hmm. You don't really get at the real world. Of course, mm-hmm. the easy way to refute that is then, well, how do you know the real world is even there then?
Mm-hmm.
And in order to see that your sense data is nothing but sense data, you have to have more than knowledge. You have to know a little bit more than the sense data to be able to differentiate between the sense data and the real world Kant says you can't know.
Yeah, Frank, play that out just a little bit more, because when I read that, this was something new to me, this particular wrinkle in the argument, and I thought it was compelling. And you talked about knowing the dividing line between two things.
Right.
Do you recall that?
Nothing but fallacy, or mm-hmm. nothing buttery fallacy in logic. And it says that nothing but statements imply more than knowledge. If I say to you that the only thing that I can understand is the sense data that I get from the real world,
mm-hmm.
then in order for me to say that the data that I have is nothing but sense data, I have to see where the sense data ends and the real world begins.
Mm-hmm.
But Kant's worldview says he can't see the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So his nothing but statement implies more than knowledge. I think the illustration we use in the book is this. If you put a white piece of paper on a black desk, the only way you can see where the white piece of paper ends and the black desk begins is to see the edge of the paper.
Yeah.
You have to be able to see both in order to see the definition of the
right.
paper.
Right.
Well, if the white piece of paper is the sense data and the real world is the black desk behind it,
mm-hmm.
you have to see part of both to see where the sense data ends and the real world begins.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Kant says you can't know.
Well,
he's implying more than knowledge in order to say you can only know the sense data. That's self-defeating.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting the way you put it just a moment ago, that in order to say that we are only seeing sense data, you've got to know there's something more, or else how do you know that the things we're seeing aren't the world as it really is?
Sure.
If you can see the world as it really is and the sense datum that represent the world but aren't the world, then you, by making the distinction, know you're looking at one and not the other. You can then make the distinction you're talking about. But if
you can know both.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to see both.
Yeah, that's
in order to make the distinction.
Right.
In order
right.
to see where my yard ends and my neighbor's begins, I have to see just beyond my property line to say, oh, there's where it ends.
Yeah, right.
And then I'm seeing some of my neighbor's line,
mm-hmm.
which is what Kant says you can't do.
Well, tell us, go through a little bit some of the, and I'd like to do this for the time together. I'm not planning to take callers because I want to have you to myself here as we talk through the argument of the book itself. What I'd like to do is start with some of the main principles. As you've described, you have a 12-step process.
Right.
It reminds me of the 12-step program. You know, I guess
right.
this is for ailing atheists. You know, we got a 12-step program for you, but it's really meant to demonstrate that the Christian worldview is very credible. It can be defended. It can be demonstrated to be reasonable, to be reasonable, to be believed beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore known. And you go through, starting from the foundation, you start building your case, and you start with the problem of truth, which we've talked about. already. And then you go to, given the fact that we can know some things and we have some tools by which we seem to be able to discover some things about reality, what we discover gives us a clue about spiritual verities. And so how would you develop that?
Exactly. And the other point we point out is that the opposite of true is false. And I love the quote by the great Muslim philosopher Avicenna, when he talked about those who deny the law of non-contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is great.
Yeah, he said, those who deny the law of non-contradiction should be beaten and burned until they admit that being beaten is not the same as not being beaten, and being burned is not the same as not being burned.
Yeah, of course, most of our listeners, I think, know the law, but why don't you run that by them in case some are new to the program?
Well, the law of non-contradiction says that it's really the first law of logic. It's the fundamental law of all thinking. It's saying that something cannot be both true and false at the same time and in the same sense.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Earth can't be flat and round at the same time mm-hmm. and in the same sense. It's mm-hmm. one or the other.
Yeah.
Your wife can't be pregnant or not pregnant at the same time and in the same sense.
Mm-hmm.
They're one or the other.
Right.
And so Avicenna's quote is just
– yeah, it's great because, in fact, I have heard that quote before, but I couldn't remember where it was, and now I know where to find it because there are people out there who will deny that the law of non-contradiction applies. And, of course, it's such a ridiculous thing because even though people may not know the law, the name of the law, or articulate the law, they use it all the time. They have to be able to survive, and that quote makes it really clear how important it is.
Right there, Greg, when they say, I deny the law of non-contradiction, they're
using
the law of non-contradiction to deny it.
Mm-hmm.
So the easy way to refute that is when they say, I deny the law of non-contradiction, you say, so you agree, it's true. And they're
right.
going to go, no, I don't. And
mm-hmm.
you say, wait, so you're contradicting me. You're using the law right now.
Yeah, that's right. It happens all the time.
You just can't get away from it.
Now, you go from there, though, to different ways of giving evidence for the existence of God to kind of start out the religious proof enterprise here.
Sure. We start with we really talk about three major arguments for Christianity, well, really for theism to be
mm-hmm.
used. The first, of course, is the cosmological argument, the argument from the beginning of the universe. The second is what we call the teleological argument, or the argument from the design of the universe and the design of life. And the third is the moral argument that says if there's a moral law prescribed on all of humanity, then there must be a moral law prescriber or mm-hmm. moral law giver.
Frank, why don't you hold it right there? We got to go to break,
sure.
But that's a good introduction for the next segment where we'll talk about these three main proofs for the existence of God. Of course, the third one I'm very familiar with myself, and we've talked about it, but I think you've got some nice angles on it here in the book and some handles that you give people that helped him to grasp this material, and I particularly like that. Talking with Frank Turk, he's the co-author with Dr. Norm Geisler of a book published by Crossway Publishers, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and we'll get back with Frank in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
For Southern California, loving talk radio, 740 KPRT, Avalon.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution.
The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind, as I do every Sunday, 3 until 5, along with Frank Turek, also giving you a piece of his mind, author with Norm Geisler of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Hey, Frank, you have, I'm looking at your stats here a little bit, and you've been on Hannity and Combs, The O'Reilly Factor, and Politically Incorrect. Those are some. That was you, right? Not Dr. Geisler.
Yeah, no, yeah. That was in response to our first book, Legislating Morality. Those were fun shows.
Well, you got a great publicist, man, to get you on those things. And those are hot seat shows. I mean, I know they're tough. I haven't been on any of those. I would not want to go, frankly, on Politically Incorrect. Now, of course, that is thankfully off the air from my perspective. Although
yeah,
I
agree with you. He's on HBO now and another.
I was on Alan Combs' national radio broadcast, but not on the TV one with Hannity and Combs. How did that go, and what was your strategy in a circumstance like that? Because you don't have much time.
No, that is always the problem. And when I was on O'Reilly, it was a back of the book section, so I was sitting right across from him. And
that would be, I think, a better circumstance than any of the others.
Yeah, of course, he didn't really read the book, and we went back and forth, and this was during impeachment. And he said, well, a majority of the American people don't want this president thrown out of office on, you know, with regard to morality or on behalf of his morality. And I said, well, you know, a majority of the American people at one point thought slavery was okay, too. Mm-hmm. Does that make it right? And he went,
yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so he said, well, Mr. Turek, you sound like you would be someone who imposed morality. And I said, well, Bill, everybody's trying to impose morality.
Do you vote?
Everyone's trying to impose morality.
Absolutely.
Trying to impose morality on health care, on abortion, on homosexual marriage, on, you know, on and on and on. Everybody's trying to impose morality. The only question is whose morality will be imposed.
Yeah, that's a very important point in that situation because people don't put that together. Simple
right.
question that I ask is, do you vote?
Yeah.
Yeah, to what purpose? To elect
right.
people to impose morality, that's what that's all about. Well, I thought
you
of one...
impose anything else.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I thought of one legislator who said, I don't like imposing morality. I said, well, then you should get out of the legislating business because that's your job, you know.
That's right.
Listen, when we finished the last segment, you talked about three lines of argument that you use to prove the existence of God, to argue for it. And I guess maybe proof is sometimes a misleading word because some people attach certainty or necessity with the word proof, and really what you're offering is a cumulative case analysis. What's the given the bulk of the evidence, what's the most reasonable conclusion to come to?
Exactly.
So the evidence that you give for the existence of God, the three points again, and how do you develop those?
Well, we start with the first one, or the beginning of the universe, or the cosmological argument, and virtually every scientist now says that the universe did explode into being out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we give the evidence for that, and we have an acronym to help people remember it, SURGE, S-U-R-G-E-S, standing for the second law of thermodynamics, U standing for the universe is expanding, R for the radiation afterglow, the heat, remnant heat from the initial explosion.
This is evidence for the Big Bang.
Evidence for the Big Bang. G is the great galaxy seeds that were discovered by the COBE satellite. Back in, I think, 1992,
mm-hmm.
And then E stands for Einstein's General Theory of Relativity.
Actually, this is almost a moot point nowadays. As you pointed out, virtually everybody agrees there was a beginning to the universe.
And here's the important point with regard to that, Greg, as you know. The point is that the universe itself came into being. In other words, according to Einstein's General Theory of Relativity, time, space, and matter are co-relative, meaning
mm-hmm.
you can't have one without the other.
Mm-hmm.
So when the universe exploded into being, it didn't explode out of anything. It exploded out of nothing.
Yeah, and nothing is nothing.
Yeah, nothing is what rocks dream about, according to Aristotle. So suddenly there was nothing, no thing, what rocks dream about, and then an entire universe exploded
mm-hmm.
and started to accelerate and expand in all directions. So it can't be that natural law is responsible for the Big Bang, because nature itself was created mm-hmm. at the Big Bang.
Right.
So it must be something outside of the natural world that brought this universe into existence, which is exactly what we mean by the word supernatural.
Right, right, right. So we've got a supernatural beginning, and of course, and I know you developed this in more detail, but I think people can see that the next step there is a supernatural beginner.
Exactly.
Because it's going to take a mind to produce the kind of world that we discover it to be.
Right. Either someone created something out of nothing or no one created something out of nothing. Now, which view is more reasonable?
Right. That's a very simple way of putting it. I like that. Get your teeth into that. Okay. But there's other evidences that we have about the nature of that beginner, and that's where these other two arguments come in, right?
Right. With regard to the teleological argument, when it comes to the universe, as you know, there's a new principle in science, new meaning 30, 35 years old, called the anthropic principle, which means that this universe is precisely tweaked to support life. In other words, there are conditions about this universe and about our world that are just so that if they were altered by, you know, a minute amount, we wouldn't be here. In fact, Hugh Ross has identified 122 of these constants or factors about our universe.
And new ones are popping up every day almost.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, you know, our distance to the sun, Jupiter being in its current orbit, you know, mm-hmm. the percentage of oxygen in our atmosphere, gravity. In fact, if gravity were altered by like one part in 10 to the 40, we wouldn't even be here.
Right, right.
I mean, it's just incredibly tweaked universe.
And there are a lot of people that are writing on this that are not Christians or they're not committed theists. They're the ones that are looking at the facts and coming to these same conclusions.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And what we found is a lot of times it's not the intellect that's in the way of scientists who refuse to accept Christianity. It's more a matter of the will.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't want to accept it because they know it has moral implications on their lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we've got the beginning of the universe. We've got the design of the universe now that tells us something about the nature of the Creator. He's intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move to the third argument.
Well, part of the second argument still is the design and origin of life.
Okay, yeah.
We point out that the first one-celled life has as much information in it as 1,000 complete sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. That's according to Richard Dawkins, an evolutionist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the human brain has about 20 million books worth of information in it. You know, if there is no designer, where did such incredible information come from?
Who wrote the books?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we use an analogy or kind of a fun thing in our book about alphabet cereal. You know, suppose you come downstairs one day and you see the alphabet cereal knocked over on the kitchen table and the letters spelled, "Take out the garbage, Mom," on the plate.
Yeah.
What do you assume? The cat knocked the box over? Earthquake shook the house? No,
right.
You say, intelligent being, Mom. Mom wants me to take out the garbage.
Right, right.
Well, if take out the garbage, Mom requires an intelligent being, then 1,000 volumes of an encyclopedia worth of specified and complex information requires an intelligent being.
You know, this actually is a good example of specified complexity, and I know you talk about this in the book, because it's not just that there is a highly organized, improbable sequence of letters in front of you, but it spells out something that is meaningful in the context that would be meaningful in the context of that circumstance, Mom telling the kid to take out garbage, even if there were no spilled alphabets. So there's kind of an external match to this sentence on the table that specifies it as an example of intelligence.
And, Greg, it's not just that we lack a natural explanation for this.
Right.
It's also that we have positive information or positive evidence that this could only come from an intelligent being.
Mm-hmm.
When you see, for example, take out the garbage, Mom, on the placemat, it's not that you just lack, as you say, a natural cause for that. It's that you have a positive information that's actually from your mom.
It's specified. In fact, I had a person that told me that, well, your mind just naturally forms things into groupings and sees order when order isn't there. We naturally do this. And I think I used the illustration of Mount Rushmore in that particular case, and you do cite that in your book, but this alphabet sentence is just as good. Yeah, well, you look at that, and my mind is not naturally forming that grouping. Anybody who looks at those letters will see the sentence. What's the best thing to infer from that?
And of course, and if you saw Mount Rushmore, you wouldn't say, oh, the wind, the rain,
imagine that.
Did that. Certainly not natural, maybe political.
Isn't that amazing? It's like, consider the chances, you know. How do you know? Truth is stranger than fiction. But, there you have more specification. It doesn't just look like a human being. It looks like four particular human beings who happen to be four presidents of the United States.
And
that's
the
specification.
And what we tried to do, Greg, and I guess you – it seems like people are agreeing with this. We tried to keep the cookies on the bottom shelf. In other words, it's written with a lot of stories and examples and – It's written with some of the interactions we've had with atheists.
There's a lot of dialogues in there, and I think that's very helpful because not only do you give the ideas, but then you give how this plays out in actual conversations that you've had at your events or encounters with people who took exception with you. By the way, before I forget it, I want to just backtrack just a little bit to that statement that you made about everything coming from nothing. How exactly did you put that? Because I'm going to write it down.
There's only two possibilities. Either someone created something out of nothing or no one created something out of nothing.
Someone or no one.
And
okay.
Which view is more reasonable?
Yeah, that's great.
Someone created something. Now, you always get the question, well, who made God?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, the answer to that is, look, there's only two possibilities. So obviously, something has always existed because you can't create yourself. So there must be something eternal.
Mm-hmm.
Either the universe is eternal or something outside the universe is eternal. We've just given evidence that the universe does not appear to be eternal. Second
right.
law, universe expanding, radiation
right.
afterglow, great galaxy seeds, and Einstein's general theory of relativity.
Mm-hmm.
The universe had a beginning. If the universe had a beginning, it must have a beginner. So there must be something outside the universe
that
is eternal.
Exactly. I don't think that people entirely grasp our argument when they raise that objection because we're not claiming that nothing can be eternal. We're claiming that in this case the universe doesn't appear to have been that thing, but some things could be. In fact, at least one thing must be.
Right.
And it ain't something natural. It's something supernatural, as you've
exactly.
argued. Let's go to the moral argument because this, I think, has a lot of power to it, and I use it a lot. In fact, I did a debate on this issue a week and a half ago at University of Washington, and I think this is one of the most powerful arguments in favor of the existence of God. Go ahead and tell us how you characterize it.
Well, we basically say that the moral law is written on the hearts of every human being, and even Jefferson pointed it out in the Declaration of Independence. And if there is a real moral law out there, then there must be a real moral lawgiver, because mm-hmm. if there's no moral lawgiver, then you can't say that, say, Mother Teresa was right and Hitler was wrong,
mm-hmm.
because it's just two people, and they just have their opinions. There must be a standard beyond Mother Teresa and a standard beyond Hitler to which we compare both of them. And that standard is, in fact, God's very nature.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is no right and wrong, or if there is no God, then there's no such thing as right and wrong. I mean,
if there is no God and there's no right and wrong, then there's no evil, and therefore then the argument against God based on the existence of evil in the world must be abandoned if you're a relativist.
Oh, in fact, and C.S. Lewis points this out brilliantly, he basically says, look, evil doesn't disprove God. It may prove there's a devil out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't disprove God, because you wouldn't know evil unless you knew good.
That's right.
We point this out in our book. We talk about a debate between Alan Keyes and Alan Dershowitz.
I saw that debate. That was a heated debate.
Oh, it was, and they're both great orators, as you know.
Uh-huh.
But
and
the best question came from the crowd, Greg. You remember this question? Because Dershowitz was going on and on about all the things that were wrong about society.
Right.
You know, it's wrong to prohibit abortion. It's wrong to prohibit gay marriage.
Uh-huh.
It's wrong to, you know, on and on and on. And so one person from the audience said, Mr. Dershowitz, what is right? And he stopped and he said, that is a great question.
Mm-hmm.
That is a fabulous question. And then he paused and he started to lecture the audience. He said, I don't know what is right, but I can tell you what is wrong.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
And then he started to list all these things were wrong. Well, Alan Keyes could have blown him out of the water by saying, Mr. Dershowitz, how can you know what is wrong unless you know what is right?
Uh-huh.
How do you know, for example, that 5 is not the right answer to 2 + 2 unless you have some idea what the right answer
mm-hmm.
is? You can't say something is wrong unless you know what is right.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
that's
if limiting abortion is wrong, then it's right not to limit abortion. I mean, this is simple. I remember that, though, and I was quite stunned by that. Is he the same guy who said that if he's going to have a big argument with God, if God, you know, thinks that he should go to hell or that something, if there is a God, he's going to have to answer to Alan Dershowitz or something along that line. I thought it was a pretty bold statement. Boy, that's going to come ringing back in his ears some year, you know, when he stands before the throne.
Everybody appeals to a standard beyond themselves, typically.
Mm-hmm.
Dershowitz was. He was saying there's an absolute standard, but he had no way of justifying that standard.
Yeah.
See, atheists can believe in right and wrong, and many do. They just have no way of justifying what is right.
Grounding it, making sense of it, right.
Right.
Okay, now you move from there, and I want to be mindful of the time here because we're more than half done, and we can't cover everything here in the book. So I want to cover some of the things that I think are really, you know, maybe would be most helpful to the audience. I want to talk a little bit about miracles, and I want to talk about the testimony of the life of Jesus, because ever since the movie The Passion came out, Of course, a lot of people are challenging the historical veracity of those accounts. This is just Mel Gibson's interpretation of the accounts, and they make the fact that he's interpreted the Gospels in some sense, and everybody has to do in some measure, that it's almost as if then there is no real verifiable, true set of circumstances that anybody knows about. Everybody just kind of makes it up as they go along. And, of course,
let's unpack that statement for just a minute if we could.
Okay.
If that's just Mel Gibson's interpretation, the person who's saying that implies that they have an objective interpretation, and Mel Gibson is straying from the objective interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's, once again, part of almost the nothing but fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that, well, that's nothing but Gibson's interpretation. Well, in order for you to say that's nothing but Gibson's interpretation, you have to know what the true story really was.
Well, you could say this, couldn't you, Frank? You could say that there are many possibilities, and therefore you have things to compare Gibson's assessment with. But in Gibson's assessment is one of those possibilities, but we aren't in a position to know which one of those possibilities is actually correct. Or then you would have a point of comparison without at least committing yourself to the idea that you know what the right one is.
Sure. At that point, then you look at the historical data to try and figure out whether Gibson was close to the truth or not, and that's what we do in the book.
Okay, let's skip the miracles per se for a moment, because I think you're going to work that into, and you can smoothly, into this historical analysis. And I'm looking at my clock. We're about a minute off from a break. So to make your job easier, we're going to break out early, and then when we come back, we'll tackle this important question on the historical reliability of the Gospels. I taught this morning at a church, and one of my points was that the person of Jesus, the identity of Jesus, not his teachings, not his actions, but the person of Christ, the identity of Christ, is the central issue of Christianity. Everything else was meant to serve that particular thing. Of course, that is all grounded in our confidence that the biblical accounts, the gospel accounts, are historically reliable. And so we are vulnerable at that point of attack, and therefore we need to be able to respond. Incidentally, we're properly and purposefully vulnerable there. We can be disproved on this point, which means that when we demonstrate the reasonableness of the gospel accounts, that gives us positive evidence for our case. So this is a good thing, not a bad thing for us. But when we return, we will talk about that with my guest, Frank Turek. He is the co-author with Norman Geisler on a book by Crossway Books entitled I Don't Have Enough, read here, Blind Faith to Be an Atheist. We'll talk more about that and the historicity of the gospel as part of his fine treatment here in the book when we return to Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Have you ever wished you could articulate your faith and beliefs more clearly? Do you feel confident when talking with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated of subjects like evolution, cloning, and stem cell research. Now you can avoid feeling uneasy or embarrassed when you want to stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today. Don't get caught by surprise. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive manner. Contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Just request our newsletter called Solid Ground. We'll send it to you free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
I saw
Now, this isn't the original. The Enforcer's plugging her ears. I guess she doesn't like this song. This is from Midnight. This is from Midnight Cowboy, the tune originally, isn't it, or something like that? You've Got Mail. I know they played it there, but there was a whole bunch of other, a lot of songs there that had their origins somewhere else. Anyway, I like that old stuff. Well, that's kind of a sappy kind of version of it, it seems to me. In any event, Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. Mind implants without brain surgery performed here every weekend, 3 until 5. And I'm glad you joined us. And I think we have a bunch of folks now listening today from the church I was at this weekend. I'm balking. I think it was Pacific Crest Church. Pacific Coast Church. Well, I don't remember the name so well, but I remember the people, and they were wonderful. We had a great time this morning. I'm also enjoying my time here with Frank Turek, the author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, co-authored with Norm Geisler. And Frank, it is published by Crossway Books. It's a great primer. In fact, I was telling Frank as we started the show that my dentist 3 days ago, as I'm propped up in the dentist's chair, he pops this into my lap, and he says, have you seen this before? And I said, yeah, I have. And he said, it's a sensational book. He had it all marked up, and he says, that one of the best I've read on this. And so, and I think it's just an exceptional, Frank, it's an exceptional one book assessment of a lot of the issues that Christians are facing. And it's not just an intellectual assessment of individual things. You build from a foundation an argument starting from ground zero, as it were, on up, and then you talk about your interactions with people at each point so people can see kind of real-life situations about how you cash this out. You have memory devices. You have good illustrations. You've got a lot of transferable notions, and you do put it – I wouldn't say you put it on the bottom shelf because not everything can get all the way down there, but you put it within reach of anybody trying to learn this stuff, and so it's nicely done. By the way, what was the breakup of activity here, writing activity, between you and Dr. Geisler? I always am interested in that when I see people have co-authored a book.
Well, as I mentioned before, Dr. Geisler and I have been doing this seminar for a while, and he really has, long before I even got to the seminary, he sort of had the logic behind this nailed down in mm-hmm. terms of...
the organization and
right, so. The organization of how you argue from ground zero to the Bible being the Word of God, but mm-hmm. what I did is I took all that and I wordsmithed it all, and then he edited it, and mm-hmm. that's why we have a consistent style through the entire book.
Right, so you got one voice there. That's good.
Right.
And it
right.
is nice. It's very nicely done. As we were moving through this argument, and we're jumping a little ahead because we can't go over all the 12 points of your argument, but one of the most important points is the authority of the New Testament documents, specifically the Gospels, because as I've argued, and Frank, I don't know what your feeling is on this, but and you're free to differ, but I've argued that even though I believe in inerrancy, we do not need an inerrant text in order to make our case for Christianity. So a lot of the arguments about the alleged contradictions in the Bible are moot as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly.
All you need is a historically reliable gospels that itemize the salient details of Jesus' life. And if those things actually happen the way the apostles characterize it, then we've made our case. Are
exactly.
you comfortable
you
with that?
You don't need an inerrant sports section to figure out who won the game yesterday.
Right.
That's you just
right.
need to know that the scores are right.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you know whether or not they got a detail wrong here or there, that's irrelevant. And the point, I mean, we deal with the issue of inerrancy a little bit in the book, but the very fact that if the New Testament documents are historically reliable, then Christianity necessarily follows.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Jesus died and rose from the dead for our sins. Hey, mm-hmm. the game's over. In fact, that's exactly what Paul said. You know, he said, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, your faith's in vain.
That's right.
That's the beauty of Christianity. You mentioned this before. Christianity is an historical, or is a religion based on historical actual event. It can be falsified or it can be found to be true mm-hmm. beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's what we found with the book. It's true beyond a reasonable doubt.
So we've got a good problem that we face. Our problem is we've got to show that Christianity is tied to history. But mm-hmm. the reason it's a good problem is once we do, we've verified the truthfulness of the theological claims of Christianity at the same time. And how do you do that?
Well, let's start very briefly, and we don't have a lot of time, but we know we have an accurate copy of the original. We've got almost 5,700 handwritten Greek manuscripts. They go way back nearly almost to the originals.
Right.
We've got 36,000 early citations from the early church fathers. We can reconstruct the original text to 99.5% accuracy. Mm-hmm. And that 0.5% we're not quite sure about. Most of that are issues regarding punctuation or spelling. They have no effect on doctrine at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we know we have what the original writers wrote down.
Mm-hmm.
Next question is, was it early? And the major arguments we make to show that these documents were written down early is that all of them must have been written by 100 A.D. because virtually every one of them was quoted by about 100 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
In other works.
Yeah.
So in order for them to be quoted, they have to have been written by them.
And circulating.
Exactly.
And say they don't get out overnight like your book got out with David Limbaugh's article. It takes a while to copy these and get them circulating so that anybody can even make reference to them.
And we also point out that most, if not all, the New Testament documents had to be written prior to 70 A.D.
Yeah.
because they do not mention the destruction of Jerusalem and
mm-hmm.
the temple. You say that's an argument from silence. No, it isn't, because the New Testament documents, some of them imply that the temple and the city were still standing when they were writing these things down.
Right.
Not only that, we use an analogy. It would be like picking up a book on the history of Lower Manhattan, and there's no mention of the World Trade Centers being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go, hey, this book would have to have been written prior to 9/11.
Right.
Any book written after that is going to say that.
Of course.
And
this is especially the case when there's a prophecy in Jesus' mouth in the book of Luke
exactly.
that says that that temple would be destroyed,
right.
and anybody who is self-serving would certainly be noting that this prophecy that some would say they put in the mouth of Jesus was in fact filled in 70.
And we know it's written, a lot of it's written before 62, because we know Acts is written by 62, because
right.
it doesn't mention the martyrdom of James, Jesus' brother.
Mm-hmm.
Josephus says that he was killed
mm-hmm.
in 62. And we know that, obviously, Luke mentions that John, the brother, or James, the brother of John, was martyred, and also Stephen was martyred.
Mm-hmm.
So Luke is mentioning these other martyrdoms, but he doesn't mention the martyrdom of Jesus' brother, nor mm-hmm. does he mention the martyrdom of Paul, whom we know was killed at the hands of Nero sometimes in the mid-60s.
Yeah, 68. Mm-hmm.
Right. This book was written by 62. If Acts is written by 62, then Luke is before that, because Luke is before Acts.
Right.
And
same
Mark
author.
Is probably before Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but you have sources that come from the 50s or even earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Gary Habermas has done some great work here.
Right.
He's discovered 41 creeds in the New Testament, probably the most important one being from 1 Corinthians 15,
right.
which they say go all scholars virtually say goes all the way back to the time of the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So the sources of the New Testament are so early that it can't be myth.
Yeah, we've got written copies of Gospels, biographies of Jesus' life within 20 to 25 years of the death of Christ. And they weren't just sitting down 25 years later and saying, gee, what did he do now? Let's try to remember whatever happened. These are things they've been talking about for 25 years, been staking their life on.
And
now they just
put
it
down.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
Luke says many have taken to write down. These things. So
mm-hmm.
Luke is actually drawing from other sources.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we know we have eyewitness testimony. We know it's early. We know it's eyewitness because just a couple quick points here. Luke in Acts from chapter 13 to the end of the book includes 84 historically confirmed details that could only have been known by an eyewitness.
Mm.
We list the 84 in the book.
Mm.
John, the Gospel of John, which is often thought to be a late gospel and maybe not written by an eyewitness, has 59 such eyewitness details or details that wouldn't have been invented.
Right.
And we list those in the book as well. We've got early testimony here, Greg.
Yeah.
Not only that, the non-Christian writers, when you line them up, when you line up their citations together, the 10 non-Christian writers who cite Jesus within 150 years of his death, they tell the same basic story that the New Testament documents
right.
say.
Right. And you've
so
got
when you add all this up, you're going, this seems historically reliable.
Yeah. If any other document had that kind of attestation, historians would accept it immediately as being sound.
You know why they don't?
In this
case. Because there's miracles in it.
Yeah, that's
the
problem.
And they say miracles can't occur.
Now, this is especially the problem of the so-called, the famous or infamous, as you might put it, Jesus Seminar, who got a lot of press the last couple of months
uh-huh.
with the Passion of the Christ. In fact, they were the go-to team to find out what, and I'm putting quotes here around this, scholars had to say about the historicity of the Gospels. What's wrong with that?
Well, most of them are atheists. Most of them, in fact, we point out that Crossan, one of the lead guys in the Jesus Seminar,
mm-hmm.
In a debate with William Lane Craig, which we chronicle in the book, said he has a presupposition against miracles.
Mm.
Well, if you have a presupposition against miracles and you go to the text and you see all these miracles in it, you're going to say, well, Jesus must not have done that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, they're ruling out the evidence before they even look.
It's like Jesus didn't raise from the dead. How do you know? Because resurrections don't happen.
That's right.
Oh, I get it.
Here's the short answer to the miracle question, though, Greg. We point this out in the book. If Genesis 1:1 is true, and virtually all the scientific evidence says it is,
that in the beginning God
floated into being out of nothing, then every other verse in the Bible is believable.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there's a God out there who could create the universe out of nothing, can he make axe heads float in water? Can he part the Red Sea? Mm-hmm. Can he keep Jonah in a whale for 3 days? I mean, we keep people in submarines for months.
Yeah.
Can God keep a guy in a whale for 3 days?
Sure.
Can he raise Jesus from the dead? Of course he can.
Of course. Now, if Genesis 1:1 is true, this, of course, doesn't prove the miracles actually happened. But what
right.
it does show is that one is not just justified in dismissing them out of hand and has to look at the evidence for each miracle on
exactly.
its own merits.
Exactly.
And what the folks in the Jesus Seminar do is dismiss them out of hand, and then that passes as scholarship. And, you know, you watch Peter Jennings, and he says, well, let's just face it, Christians, you guys are wishing on a star. We know better now because John Dominic Crossan and Robert Funk and the rest of them at the Jesus Seminar have now made their claims. Now, you've actually chronicled details of how they do their work, and I noticed an appendix item,
right.
too, where you talk about why the conclusions of the Jesus Seminar can't be relied upon.
Right. Well, Peter Jennings and the Jesus Seminar have to have a lot more faith than you and I, Greg.
Yeah, yeah, which
really
is really the point of your book. It was kind of nice how you did that. We moved right back to the title. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Norm Geisler co-authored with Frank Turek, and of course, Frank has been our guest here for this hour. What do you think, here in just a couple of minutes, do you think are in the book, based on what you've done in there, your knowledge of the material, you think would be the most helpful to a Christian? I really like what you've got here on the historical Jesus, and I think I'm going to go back and consume a little bit more of that, because a lot of this stuff I have access to the information, but I like the way you've put it in a very handy, usable, transferable kind of form there. So what is your, in a sense, favorite or more most practical part of the book? That
let me point out one chapter we haven't gotten to yet, and that's chapter 11, which are the top 10 reasons we know the New Testament writers told
okay.
the truth.
Yeah, that's
I think
great.
That's really practical, because that sort of nailed it for me. It's one thing to have an accurate manuscript. It's one thing to say they were eyewitnesses. It's one thing to say they were early eyewitnesses. But it's another thing to say that what they actually wrote down was true, because they could be lying early eyewitnesses, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And so we have these 10 reasons. Obviously, I can't get through them all. But here's a couple things that I need to ask you. If you were making up a story about Jesus rising from the dead, would you say that you were stupid, uncaring, rebuked, doubting cowards? I mean, because that's basically how they depict themselves.
That's right. Yeah, it's not very flattering, huh?
Yeah, they don't know what Jesus is talking about. They fall asleep on him in the garden in his greatest hour of need. Jesus calls one of the leaders of the church, Peter, Satan,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Peter denies him 3 times. They're doubting even after the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And while the crucifixion is going on, they run away while the brave women come down and discover the empty tomb. Now, I know... Greg, if I were writing down this, I would never have the women go find the empty tomb while I was hiding for fear of the Jews.
So this really falls under the category, and this is very compelling from a historical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to the veracity of the text and the writers, that they include all these embarrassing, self-incriminating issues or elements in there. And, of course, the women at the tomb, women didn't have the high position in society that they have today.
Their testimony wasn't even considered admissible.
Right.
Why would you make them the first witnesses?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no way you do that.
Unless that's the way it happened.
And the kind of the bottom line to the whole chapter is what motive did the New Testament writers have for making up a story? Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing the story got them was excommunication from their faith, abuse, torture, and martyrdom.
Right.
Hardly a list of perks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, you don't go around saying, hey, you know, we made up this, or we got this story about Jesus rising from the dead. If it wasn't really true, they would have cracked. I mean,
sure.
11 of the 12 went to their deaths for it.
Mm-hmm.
One of them would have cracked and said, look, this thing got out of hand here.
Right. I have a saying that's written down by my desk, and it says, myths don't make martyrs.
That's right.
Well, especially if they're martyrs who know that it's a myth, and that's
right. We've got to point that out, because Muslims will go die for their faith right now.
Right.
but Muslims don't know for sure it's true, whereas the New Testament witnesses were there and can empirically verify.
Yeah, and if the New Testament accounts are false, they were lies, they were fabrications, then those guys knew it. Hey, listen, Frank, it's great talking to you. I'm sorry we ran out of time, but hope to see you before too long. Thanks.
Great show. Thanks.
You're welcome. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Norm Geisler and Frank Turek, of course, Frank, our guest for the last hour. Crossway Books. Now, we have an hour ahead, friends, and the lines are now open. And you're welcome to call in on anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. And stay with us because I'm going to talk to you about Texas A&M, University of Washington in Seattle, and Berkeley last weekend. Stay with us at Stand to Reason. All right, friends, here we are. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. And I'm ready for you, 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Actually, lines are getting filled up already. And I'm going to get to you shortly. I got a lot to talk to you about. In fact, I could probably talk the whole hour. I won't do that because I will take your calls. But, boy, so much has happened since the last time I talked to you. I've been on three campuses. Been in one debate. I'm actually going to another school and another debate next week. So, and then tomorrow, well, I'll tell you about what happens tomorrow in just a moment. Before I get to those details, though, I want to warn you about a movie. Occasionally, I talk about films, either good ones that I've seen or bad ones that I've seen, so I can tell you to spend your money wisely or to stay away. And I saw a movie that, after a fashion, I guess I have to admit I enjoyed. But having seen it, I'm not going to recommend it. And part of the reason is it's very, very raw. It was nicely done, a lot of action. You could sympathize with the main character. It's one of those comic book characters made into a full-length feature film. And the title of the film is The Punisher, starring John Travolta, who is not the title character. Tom Jane plays that. And apparently, and I read some stuff on the internet, this movie does a very good job of capturing the character of the comic book series. And this is the opening scene of this comic book series character's life. How did he become the Punisher? The problem, of course, with any of these vigilante-type action heroes from the comic books is they always have to go through some radical disaster that they survive that puts them on the warpath with the bad guys. And, of course, you see this in this movie where 30 people get gunned down one by one, and then the Punisher, played by Tom Jane, his wife and child get pursued and then run over by a truck. And he gets blown up but survives it, and that sets the stage for him to go back after John Travolta and all the rest of them associated with Travolta, including Travolta's wife, who put the hit out on the Punisher's entire family, and then get revenge. This is a revenge film, and it's a film, and this is one of the satisfying things. And I got to chuckle because it's just me, and I think maybe guys resonate with this. I don't know. I think it's maybe a twisted response to my proper sense of justice. But do you ever watch a movie where the bad guys are really bad, and then when they finally get justice, they die too quickly? It's like they turn around and explode or something, and they didn't even have a chance to think about the fact that now they're getting it for what they did. And there's just a little bit of, you know, dissatisfaction, a discordance to the ending there. I noticed, like in Revelations 20, you got the great white throne judgment. And remember, Jesus said that there's nothing that's hidden that won't be known. There he's got a long, drawn-out judgment scene where everybody gets to look at his whole life, and then he finds out that he is being punished justly. He doesn't just get zapped into non-existence. He gets judged based on the details, and then he is cast into outer darkness, the lake of fire, away from the presence of the Lord forever. So there's a sense in which everybody gets their due and they know what they're getting. And when you watch some of these programs where people are really bad, sometimes they go too quickly. Well, I promise you, in the movie The Punisher, nobody dies too quickly. None of the bad guys goes out in a poof of smoke. All of them die slow enough to know, almost in every case, that they're getting it for what they deserve. And that is one of the satisfying parts for me after a fashion. But at the same time, It is one of the it makes the movie gruesome. And I have to say I had mixed feelings because there was this satisfaction that I mentioned, but there was also this sense of being sullied by the violence. And so my recommendation is you don't see this movie. Maybe you've already seen it. You know what I'm talking about. And I hope that the way I've depicted it hasn't made it too appealing so you disregard my recommendation. There are other good movies out there. I haven't seen many lately because I've been busy. And I, but this I think you should just bypass, all right, and find something else. I have been moving around quite a bit in the last 3 weeks. I was at Texas A&M 2 or 3 weeks ago. I can't really keep track of very much anymore where I was because I was just moving so quickly. And then I'd come home, then I'd go out again, then I'd come home, then I'd go out again. And I did miss you last weekend because I was up in Berkeley speaking at the University of California there and also speaking to the local church, the Berkland Baptist Church, which is a sensational group of primarily Asian Christians that are being great ambassadors for Christ and are taking on unbelief there up in Oakland and Berkeley. Many of the members there are students at Berkeley or have been students, and so they're doing a great job. I came up at their behest, but I'm getting ahead of myself. I was in Texas A&M about 2.5 weeks ago, and that was the week before Easter, by the way. And that was Resurrection Week. This is an event that they have every year. They had every year for a number of years, and had been very successful. This time, however, they had taken a gap of a week, a year or two without having it, and so they're starting it up again, and it hadn't built much momentum. Apparently, there's a lot of apathy on that campus. I didn't run into a lot of opposition, to be honest with you, and I spoke at a couple of events, and the attendance was not very large. And so I was a little troubled by that, and of course they said, well, you know, a lot of apathy there. Now, this is a campus, by the way, that is not as aggressively non-Christian as many others. A lot of the kids come from the Bible Belt there, and they are nominal Christians. And sometimes, and you think about this from your own experience, friends, sometimes nominal Christians are the hardest to deal with. That is, people who think they're Christians, that they know all the right things, they say all the right things, but you just wonder when you look at their life if there's any genuine evidence of regeneration in their life. As one person was asking me about this, and a friend of theirs, this morning when I taught, and I mentioned, well, look at if the government were to outlaw Christianity and execute all Christians, would they be able to make a case against that person? And if they can't make a case against them because of their conduct or lack of conduct, then it's going to be hard for Jesus to make a case for them, it seems to me, and they're likely to hear the words, not well done, good and faithful servant, but depart from me. I never knew you. Those have got to be the most chilling words anyone would ever hear, and there are many who thought they were Christians that are going to hear those words, by the way. Well, as I said, because there is this quasi-Christian element there, there just seems to be a lot of apathy. But I did give some talks, and I think they went well as far as it went. The most memorable time that I had was actually driving back with a Stand to Reason person, somebody who was from the area, who's gotten our tapes and listened to our broadcast on the internet, and I had a great time with him. In fact, he drove down from Dallas, I think, which is about a 3.5-hour drive, and then drove me from Texas A&M 2 hours down to Houston, where I got on the airplane, and we had a great conversation. And there's something he said that stuck with me, and it has had a pretty strong influence on me, and I wanted to pass it on. He had been a Marine officer candidate and actually gone through a significant amount of the training before health concerns disqualified him. And he mentioned something that they used to say in their training, and here's what it was. They said, the more you – and you can write this down. This is worth remembering. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. Now, this was meant to be an encouragement for when they were sweating in training. I mean, that was hard, right? Running and working out and all the things they have to do. And that's hard work. But remember, be motivated. The more you sweat here, the less you bleed there. Well, that has great application to the Christian life. In fact, I was anticipating the next week when I would be debating on relativism at the University of Washington in Seattle. And I thought of those words because, you know, I've done a few of these debates, and I get a little nervous at them. I never know what I'm going to run into, and so it's natural for me to be nervous. And this was something that encouraged me. You don't want to be nervous, Kokel? You want to do a good job? You don't want to bleed as much in battle? Hit the books. Prepare hard. And this is good for every single one of us, every single ambassador for Christ. You're concerned about getting out there, taking the shots, bleeding in battle? Do your homework. You know, you ever take a test that you didn't mind taking? A lot of people don't like tests. Most people don't like tests, but sometimes you don't mind taking them. If you what? If you know the answers. You want to get out there and know the answers. And if you know the answers, then you're not going to have a hard time, not as hard a time. And so this was an encouragement to me just to stick with it, to work hard, to be a student of my craft, to be a good ambassador, simply put. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. Well, I came home for a few days, and then I guess it was the following week. This would be the week after Easter then. I got in a plane and flew to Seattle. My sister lives there, and her husband and her two adult children who have graduated from the University of Washington. And it was great spending some time with them, and I got together with J. Wesley Richards and my sister and her husband and my niece and nephew, and we had dinner. J. Wesley Richards from the I can't think of the name of the organization. I'm just drawing a blank there. I'll think of it in a little while. But, of course, he's doing a lot of work with the issue of intelligent design. It was great to talk with him. Then the next day I got on campus at noon, and I trained some of the Christians there. I was a host of my host at that event was Campus Crusade for Christ, and Dwayne was the director there, and he helped out, and he was tremendous. He had been at Oregon State University and set up a debate for me there, and now he was up there in Washington and set this one up. But he was telling me about the person we were debating, and we couldn't find a PhD to take this. Frankly, it's getting harder and harder to find somebody with advanced training to take the moral non-realist position, to take the relativistic position. And part of the reason is it's just not a defensible view. The minute you say that there is no moral difference between Hitler and a Mother Teresa, I mean, you've pretty much given up the ship. That's all over. And people see that. But that's what a relativist must say. They were able to drum up, though, a philosophy graduate student, that I should say a philosophy grad. He was no longer a student. He had his MA in philosophy. And he's a former punk rocker and an atheist, and his name was Clive. And as I said, I get a little nervous at these things. You never know who you're going to run into. And even though this guy was not a PhD, I never take these circumstances lightly. It's natural to have butterflies, and yes, even I have them. All right. But when I talked to Dwayne about the situation there, he was very concerned about Clive. He had talked with him and got to know him a little bit. And, you know, he's a nice guy, Clive was, and easygoing and mellow. Now, he obviously didn't believe like I did, and he was willing to debate me on this issue. But Dwayne told me that Clive was a little nervous, and that when he read my own vita, my background, he said, boy, this guy does this a lot. This is what he does for a living. I've never done a debate before. And so Clive was kind of nervous going into this situation. And of course, when Dwayne is telling me this and my nervousness is going down, I sense an advantage, right? Oh, great. You know, I've got him. But Dwayne sensed a different advantage. Dwayne said, listen, this guy's nervous. Let's do everything we can, he said, to put Clive at ease and make him feel comfortable. In fact, he told me, I've scheduled dinner with him and you tonight together before the debate. Now, I got to tell you, friends, when he told me that we were going to dinner with my debate opponent before the debate, I thought he'd lost his mind. Now, I didn't say that to him, but I'm thinking, are you crazy? Why give the opponent an advantage? That was my thinking. I'll let him sit on pins and needles. Let him be uncomfortable. That gives me an advantage going into it. But of course, I'm thinking about myself, and I didn't share my shallow thoughts. I said, well, okay, whatever you want. That's a great idea. I lied, right? In other words, I'm going to cooperate even though I'm thinking, oh my gosh, we'll lose the advantage here. Well, friends, I didn't need any more advantage than the truth.
I had the truth in this circumstance. I didn't need the extra stuff. And frankly, when we sat down at a greasy spoon and ate hot dogs together, the three of us, I discovered not an enemy, but a human being who needed to know Jesus. Nice guy, easygoing, nervous. We tried to put him at ease. In fact, by the end of the conversation that evening, I was giving him debate tips, trying to help him out. And I assured him that this wasn't going to be a bloodbath, that it wasn't going to be a pitched battle, but two guys trying to speak as intelligently as possible about a critical issue, moral truth. And when I left, I was so relaxed. And thanks to Dwayne, so was Clive. And when we got to the debate, of course, it went very well. It pretty much went my way. I guess I should tell you what my brother-in-law said. He said it wasn't a debate. It was a massacre on the merits. And I think that, of course, our view is strong. And my opponent did the best he could with the material he had, but he was just defending a weak view. Nothing against him. But through that entire debate, I tried my best to be gracious and kind to him. And it was easy because we'd become maybe not friends, but at least friendly acquaintances. And I'm so thankful to Dwayne's example there to me. Now, we always are concerned about the character issue. You know that, not to put an extra stumbling block before someone. But Dwayne taught me something new about this, that I need to excel still more, and it deeply influenced me. By the way, at the end of the debate, I walked over, and as the audience is applauding there in the venue there on campus, I shook hands with Clive, and Clive leaned over, and he said, you know, thank you for putting on the kid gloves. Thank you for handling me carefully and not destroying me as you could have. Boy, what a powerful testimony. I can't take credit for that. That was Dwayne's idea. But it shows how bright it was and how important and appropriate it was. And it just really went well. So I thank Dwayne for that instruction to me. That was University of Washington in Seattle. Came back from that on a Thursday and stayed overnight Thursday at my home. And then on Friday last, I should say a week ago Friday, I climbed on an airplane and flew to Berkeley. And that night, I did a lecture on moral relativism on campus, right? A couple buildings away from Sproul Hall, where all of the heavy-duty free speech movement happened in the late 70s, or rather late 60s and 70s. I should say all through the 60s and the early 70s. And then Saturday night in the same venue, I talked about religious pluralism, the religious version of relativism, and I argued for Jesus being the only way. And the venue held 400 people. It was filled every night. There was overflow into overflow rooms where they had video that was piped in so people could hear the talk. And when I return, I'll tell you a little bit about what happened at Berkeley. It was quite interesting. And then I'll get to your calls right here on Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Yeehaw! I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend.
I'm back in the saddle, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Live and lively. Glad to be here.
Riding the range once more.
I've been talking about the last couple of weeks as I've been traveling and speaking in some different universities, Texas A&M, the week before Easter and the week after my debate in at the University of Washington in Seattle and how that went, and then last weekend at Berkeley, and I gave two lectures at Cal there, one on moral relativism on Friday night and the other one on religious pluralism on Saturday night, and I ended with a very, very strong challenge with regards to the cross of Christ. Now, here was two things that stood out. One is the general attitude or the general response to me by the people in Berkeley, and in one particular challenger during the Q&A, because I gave about an hour lecture, and then I had about a half hour, 45 minutes of open Q&A from the microphones. And by the way, I have the videotapes of these. We're not making them available because there's no real market for that. But the reason I have them is because I can then look at them and I can get my story straight. I'm not evangelistic, you know, as far as to what things actually took place. So I reviewed these tapes. Here's the first thing that stood out for me. The Berkeley crowd was one of the best crowds I have ever spoken to in my life. Now, I need to qualify this. The gallery held 400 people, and it was filled. I would say 75 to 80% of the people in the gallery were Asians. And that in part because I was sponsored by an Asian church, which has very aggressive Christians who invited a lot of their friends to this event. So a lot of the people there were believers. I don't know what the actual numbers were. I know there were a massive amount of non-believers, and that's good. But a lot of them were believers, so believers are on my side. But it wasn't just the believers that were responding and everybody else sitting on their hands looking blankly at me. The whole audience was very responsive. They were friendly. They were warm. They were engaged. They asked good questions. They challenged me on a number of points. And I had the sense that they really wanted to hear about this information. A few months back, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago, Dr. William Lane Craig was at the same campus and got the same kind of response. Something's going on there. Now, this campus is very, very liberal. I mean, of course, it's Cal, for goodness sake. It's Berkeley. And the professors are attacking Christians left and right. And it's a very politically correct campus. Yet at the same time, there was a high degree of spiritual hunger that brought a standing room only crowd to both of those lectures that night. And I was very impressed with it. It was very easy to give my talks because the audience was so good. Now, the one particular question that stood out, and there were a lot of questions that I had to deal with, but one of them that stood out was the guy that denied that there were moral truths, and he said that there were no moral truths because they weren't universal and self-evident. And listen to this. He said if you ask a 2-year-old whether murder is wrong, then he wouldn't be able to say murder is wrong. Now, the reason that he wouldn't be able to say murder is wrong is because he's 2, for goodness sake. You know, you have to have a little brain development to be able to have the capacities that are innate in human beings to grasp these moral truisms, for one. And I tried to point out that this was the problem, not the other. Just because a 2-year-old couldn't get it right doesn't mean the truths aren't universal and they aren't grasped by a faculty called moral intuition. And so I said, well, look, a 2-year-old isn't going to be able to tell you that the square root of 4 is 2 either. Pretty safe ground there. That one I can work out in my head. And he said, well, the reason that we know that the square root of 4 is 2 is because of the way our language works. Our culture teaches us that the square root of 4 is 2. Now, I know this move, ladies and gentlemen, but I was still caught gawking flat-footed when he said it. I thought to myself, I can't believe I'm actually hearing someone say this, that the fact that the square root of 4 is 2 is a cultural construction, a function of our language. And then I was gaping for a moment, so he began to move on. And I said, no, wait. We need to pause here for just a moment and talk about this, because I don't know if we can have any further meaningful discussion if we don't deal with this issue. Is there some uncertainty in your mind as to the fact that the square root of 4 is 2? Well, this is what my culture has taught me. I said, wait a minute. We're speaking English here, right? Yeah. We all have the same language. And by the way, it wouldn't matter what language we're speaking. We could be speaking Thai or Cambodian or Cantonese. Doesn't matter. We're still talking about the same thing. You know what the concept of square root is, don't you? You understand that, yes. You know what 4 is, yes. You know what 2 is, yes. Can't you just gaze at the concept, regardless of how you learned it first off? Maybe your teachers told you the square root of 4 is 2. That's how you learned it. That doesn't matter how you learned it. The question is whether or not it's so. And can't you just gaze at the thing itself? Can't you just consider it? And with your mental faculties, your rational intuitions, can't you simply see that the fact that the square root of 4 is 2 is not a cultural convention? It's not a construction of your language, but it's a fact indeed. Well, that's what my culture teaches me. And then he went on to try to spin this tale about constructivism with language. And I said, wait a minute, let me save you some time. I know the story. And I'm not in the least bit impressed by it. I think, frankly, and I don't mean anything personal to you, but I think it's foolishness. We know better. Our world is not constructed by our language. In fact, our lives depend upon the fact that our world is not constructed by our language. If it were, we'd all be dead. If we lived in that way, we'd be dead. Because many people rely on medicine to stay alive, and the medicinal quality of drugs is not based on language. It's based on qualities in the drugs themselves as it pertains to your actual body and your actual disease. It saves you. And if you didn't take those things, you'd be dead regardless of what language you speak. It was quite stunning for me to actually talk to somebody. I know they're out there. I know a lot of people are tempted by this thing, but for somebody to stand there and actually try to convince me that the square root of 2, I'm sorry, of 4 was not 2, but was just a social construction. And I heard from others, by the way, who were actually in the overflow room, and they were yelling at the gentleman who was pursuing this issue with me at the screen. And they were throwing things at it. And they were saying, just sit down. Admit that you're beat. And frankly, I wasn't trying to beat him. Not in so many words. I was just trying to get him to see the foolishness of this idea. The idea beats itself. You get somebody to state something like that clearly, and the whole world can see the foolishness. And this is where I employ a principle I learned from Rush Limbaugh, listening to him when I was a brand new broadcaster. And the principle is this: when somebody wants to make a fool out of themselves, get out of the way. All right, so we got a lot of people here on the line, and let me jump in and get to our first caller and see if we can get through you all here before the end of the show. Steve, welcome to Stand to Reason.
How's it going, Greg?
I'm doing fine, thanks. How are you?
You said something the last hour that kind of surprised me to hear from you, but it was actually a conclusion I had also come to on my own, but it was what you had mentioned, that the Bible doesn't necessarily have to be accurate in every nook and cranny and detail, yet the story could be true.
Yeah, what I said was inerrancy, as we understand it as evangelicals, that every jot and tittle is inspired by God, and everything that the Bible affirms is true as it's stated there. That we don't have to demonstrate that the Bible is without flaw in order to demonstrate that the Christian account or that Christianity is true, because the truthfulness of Christianity doesn't hinge on the inerrancy of the Bible. And I'm speaking of something very precisely here and very specific when I talk about the inerrancy of the Bible. It hinges on Jesus died and resurrected, such that somebody even without a Bible who has communicated the truth about the death and resurrection of Jesus and the reasons that he did that can still put a viable faith or trust in Christ and become a Christian and be saved if the account that is rendered to him is accurate.
even without any Bible at all. Now, I believe in inerrancy. I believe in that. I'm just simply making the distinction, and Frank Turek backed me up on this, that you don't have to argue for inerrancy in order to make a legitimate case for the truthfulness of Christianity. Does that make sense?
Yes. Now, I understand. So you do believe in inerrancy.
I do.
It almost sounded like you had said, because you didn't detail it as much as you just did
right
just now. It sounded like you might have implied that there could be contradictions in the Bible, but it doesn't mean the general story is not true.
Yeah, well, I think actually I do believe that. Okay, let me clarify. I believe in inerrancy. However, even if it turned out that there are inaccuracies in the Bible or contradictions, all right, certainly this would create a problem for the doctrine of inerrancy, but it wouldn't create a problem for the truthfulness of Christianity, as long as we can demonstrate that the historical accounts about the life of Jesus are reliable in their salient details, all right? So I would say, let's just say worst-case scenario, there are contradictions in the Bible. Does that undermine the case for Christianity? And my response is no. Now, I don't think there are contradictions. I think there are apparent contradictions, but I don't think there are actual contradictions. But what if I'm wrong about that? What does that do to the case for Christianity? It does nothing to it. That's my point.
Right.
We can feel safe in even being willing to say for the sake of discussion that worst case scenario is that the Bible's not inerrant. It does have contradictions, but that doesn't undermine the case for Christianity. Basically.
You know, I'll let you go with this. Some years ago, I don't know if you know who Frank Zindler is. He's a well-spoken, the author of Atheism.
He's, yes, right.
He's very articulate and so forth. He was
Frank Zindler. Is he dead now?
I really couldn't tell you. I don't know. I know he debated. He had a debate at Saddleback Church some years ago.
Oh,
I got
yes.
the video.
Right. That's where I remember the name from. Right. Okay.
But anyway, to make a long story short, he was on a radio program and he left his number. And I actually called, I wrote him a letter that he called me back. And we got into a correspondence for a while. And he sent me a whole bunch of information, why the book of Daniel wasn't accurate and why this wasn't accurate, things he had written. And I wrote him back. I said, I read through all your stuff. And I says, just suppose that everything you said in these articles is true. I says, but that doesn't mean the key details of the gospel are wrong. Are inaccurate. That the Bible still is, true that Christ died for us. And
right.
Wrote
Christianity doesn't rest on the book of Daniel.
Exactly.
Rests on the person of Jesus.
Yeah, there were other books he had sent me things
right.
about. But, he really had no response to that because right. I was willing to grant that, just say all these contradictions you're bringing up are there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the Bible story isn't true overall.
I've also found that when they talk about contradictions, they are often including a whole bunch of things in the analysis that aren't contradictions at all. They're just things that they don't like. A contradiction is such that that both things can't be by logical exclusion can't be true at the same time. And if one author says that Jesus, he identifies one demoniac at the gathering demoniacs, another one identifies two, well, that's not a contradiction because one author could have been talking about one and not bringing the other one in, where the other one talked about both of them there. So that's not a contradiction. It can be the case that there is one there and there is another there as well. And so it's not a contradiction.
David Jeremiah had a quote one time that he was quoting from someone else. I don't know who came up with it, but he basically said something like this. And I don't even know if I'm quoting it accurately because I don't have it written in front of me. But it says, the honest doubter asks or the honest skeptic asks the honest questions, but the unbeliever doesn't want to hear the answers, something to that effect.
That's often the case. And sometimes we have legitimate objections that need to be addressed, but I think you're right. There are a lot of times when people are just blowing smoke.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Steve, I appreciate your call. Let's go to – do we have time for another call? Yeah, we do. Let's go to Trudy. And Trudy, I thank you for calling here at Stand to Reason. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
First of all, quickly, can you tell me who that quote was, the more you sweat in training? Who was that quote?
Well, it was a gentleman that drove me to the airport, and it's something he learned in Marine Corps training. I think it actually goes, when he was in training as a Marine officer, this is what they said constantly. They also said something like pain is when something is leaving the body. I can't remember. It's like pain is when weakness is leaving the body. When you feel pain, that's weakness leaving the body. You know, you can see them when they drop them for 50 and they're feeling it about number 45. That hurt? Yeah, that's weakness leaving the body, you know, kind of thing. But okay. It was a great comment. And I think the precise way that they put it, I actually changed it just a little bit because I like to improve things. The way he told it to me was, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in war. Okay, but I thought bleed in battle had a little better euphony. It sounded better because of the alliteration there. So in any event, his quote, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in war.
All right, now my question.
Marine Corps.
I have recently been reading a discussion online, and there are a group of people talking about the fall. And part of the people are Calvinists, and part of the people are not Calvinists.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally have never heard this before, but one of the people was arguing that God caused the fall to happen. And I'm okay with once Adam sinned, all of us were tainted with sin after that.
Yes.
But for me to try to say God set it up so that he would sin, I kind of was thinking that didn't sound real good. And so I thought I would call and find out what your thoughts
were. Well, here you get in kind of refined issues of theology that I do not traffic well in, but let me make a distinction. The discussion here is about the decree for the fall. What is the nature of God's decree about the fall? And I understand it, and I think sometimes it's hard to completely cash this out. What exactly did God do, or how does he accomplish this thing? Yes, God decreed the fall. Now, does that mean God caused the fall? I don't think that's what it means. I mean, in some sense, that God set up the world in such a way that he allowed this to take place in the way that it did, so that as an act of his permission, and maybe this is a little bit of a weak way of putting the decree, and it could be stated more strongly, suffice it to say that God, with my limited understanding, that God established it so that man would be able to freely fall so that God can fulfill his purposes. God allowed it to happen. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
To go
the other direction, even if you strengthen that a little bit, make it a little bit more robust or a little bit more aggressive in terms of God's involvement, if you take it too far and say that God caused the fall, then God is responsible for what he causes. And not just makes possible, but what he causes. And on this view, God actually caused the fall. If God caused the fall and the fall is evil, then God causes evil and God is evil. And
that's
I don't see any way
around that. That's where I was going. I don't see any way around that if that's the case.
Yeah.
And I'm going, okay, and I knew that there was the verse that said God is not the author of confusion.
Yeah.
But then I thought there was something else that relative to the effect.
In him is light and there is no darkness at all, it says in the scripture. You go to James chapter 1, it says that God cannot be tempted by evil.
Oh, good.
There is nothing evil about God's character. He doesn't participate in evil at all. The seraphim and cherubim are singing what? Holy, holy, holy.
Okay, because I was just going, y'all, this is just sounding
right.
Whack time to me.
Well, some people just, I think, get confused, and they get a little excited about some things they're learning, and then they just go over the cliff.
That's where I'm going. And I'm finding more and more that some of the people just, they get so hung up in little minutiae things that they miss the big picture.
Yeah, they're fighting the wrong battles. You know, they get contentious in the things they're doing. And listen, I will tell you this. My experience with people like that is, they're not that responsive oftentimes to conversation. I frankly wouldn't spend a lot of time trying to change their mind. Avoid such men as these kind of thing. This is not a hill to die on, frankly.
Well, no, I agree with that, too, but I was going, what on earth? I'm going, okay, if God is not the author of sin, confusion, and then he also, like you're saying, everything is for his glory, how would he set up? I just was kind of...
Well, it's not so much that God... those two references that you just offered, I don't think are helpful in this debate. The 1 Corinthians 14 says God is not the author of confusion. It's talking about, tongues being used, whether out interpreters and stuff. I think what we have to keep in mind is God is not the author of evil, of moral evil.
Right.
And there's no darkness in him at all. He is holy. And because of that, then, he is not the creator of the fall, even though he might have decreed that it be allowed to happen. So there you go, Trudy. Thank you for your call. And we got to go to break, and I'll come back and get some more of your calls. I am Greg Kokel, and the show is Stand to Reason.
Have you ever wished you could articulate your faith and beliefs more clearly? Do you feel confident when talking with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated of subjects like evolution, cloning, and stem cell research. Now you can avoid feeling uneasy or embarrassed when you want to stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today. Don't get caught by surprise. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive manner. Contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Just request our newsletter called Solid Ground. We'll send it to you free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Some people call me a space cowboy. Yeah. Some people be the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice. Woo! Woo!
Thank you, Homer. Greg Kokel here, back on Stand to Reason. Listen, I need your help about something. I don't do this very often, that is request specifically prayer, but tomorrow I'm doing something I never did before. I'm actually taping a show on MTV. You know MTV, right? This is the great field for the gospel. But they're doing a new show called The Debate Show, and it hasn't aired yet. And I don't know if this is the first or second or third, but I've been asked to participate in a half hour this half-hour program in which they debate issues of the day. And it's kind of, I don't know if it's a roundtable situation or what, you know, interactive discussion, but it should be fairly intense. And the issue is same-sex marriage. Now, this is a tough issue to handle in a public forum. If I can't control all the options, the reason it's tough is that it's you have to get things going in the right direction to help people to understand what's going on. Unfortunately, what happens is you get caught in a crossfire of rights claims, and you can't make any sense out of the issue when people are doing that kind of thing. You got to figure out, well, what is marriage at all before you can start talking about that issue. Now, I'll get back with you on next Sunday about how things went, and I'll tell you what happened and whatever, and as best as I'm able to keep you apprised of this, I will tell you when that show will be aired. For any of those of you who can get on cable MTV, you can see the show. But that's tomorrow. It's around they're picking me up at 4 or something like that, so something between 4 and 7. By 7 o'clock Los Angeles time tomorrow, we should be finished. So if you could pray for me, I would I'd appreciate that. Here's what I'd like you to pray, that I would be clear and persuasive, that I would speak as I ought to speak, but speak in a way that makes sense of the argument. And this is the hardest thing to do in sound bites, to try to characterize this issue the way it needs to be done. And I'm going to do the best that I can, and I have some good things lined up, but I need your help too, because I need the Lord's help, and you can help. The Lord help me after a fashion by praying. So thank you for that. Let's go to Justin, and I'm going to move as quickly as I can through these last four calls. So if each of you could be as to the point as possible. Justin from South Dakota, thank you for calling today.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Justin.
Good, thanks. Hey, that's just wonderful to hear that you're doing that tomorrow, because I'm also doing a topic on homosexuality tomorrow.
Uh-huh. Tomorrow? Where at?
Tomorrow, yeah. I have a speech at my college. I go to the University of South Dakota.
Good for you.
And so, I don't think I could have said it better. You said you want to make a clear, persuasive argument that makes sense. That's exactly what I want to do, and that's exactly what my question is, how to go about doing that.
By the way, is this a talk or a debate?
This is just a speech.
Okay, great. How much time do you have?
I have, at least a half hour. So.
Oh, well, that's good. You got quite a bit of time. Good. Yeah. Okay, so what do you have so far?
Well, I have twofold kind of thing. I want to do the facts on homosexuality, like the medical facts,
mm-hmm.
and just point that out, and then I want to talk about not so much as that, but more of the morality issues.
The moral issue, yeah. Well, that's good.
The tolerance. Because what our problem is, we have to take a social problem and solve it in an ecological way. And I don't know if
in an ecological way.
What? Yeah, an ecological.
I don't know what that means.
I don't really either. They don't explain it very well. But
solving it, okay.
I'm gonna try and solve it the best way that.
All right,
I know how.
And then you take your hits from the others, right? By the way, when you do the factual stuff, you got to make sure that your facts are coming from they're not coming from a bunch of Christian books, but they're coming from peer-reviewed sources. That is good technical literature in the field that people are not going to be able to easily find fault with.
Okay,
tactically, this is important. Now, maybe it's too late because you got your talk all together and you got your sources. But if you quote me or you quote Focus on the Family on factual issues, people are going to be inclined to reject them because they will mistakenly think because we're Christians, we can't get the facts right.
Right.
But that is an error in thinking on their part. But in any event, don't even give them that opportunity. You can go to Time Magazine. If you go to Nature, you can go to whatever sources that seem to be either neutral or on the side of the non-Christian. On the side of the homosexual. Then that's going to be very difficult for them to take exception with.
Yeah, and I think I have several of those sources.
Okay, good.
And the thing I actually want to kind of point out, though, is after the facts say, well, why we have to pose questions, and I want to pose a question: why, if homosexuality is so dangerous, why is it still being accepted? And
you mean physically dangerous, the health risks,
right.
Is what you mean? Yeah, and that's just a great descriptive situation. Here are the problems. You don't have to make any moral assessments to show that this is not healthy. Good.
Right.
Okay.
And then I just want to you pose a question: well, why is it still being accepted if there's so much harm being done, and then go into things like, the moral relativism that comes into play,
mm-hmm.
and the tolerance issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I didn't know. I was kind of gonna see if I can get any more advice if you have.
Okay. Well, when you talk about tolerance, you need to understand so that you can make this clear to your audience the difference between the old standard of tolerance and the new standard of tolerance.
Okay.
The new definition of tolerance is you can't disagree with people.
Right.
But of course, this isn't going to work because if they say that you're being intolerant because you're disagreeing with homosexuals, then they are being intolerant to you because they're disagreeing with you.
Yeah.
Do you see that?
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of time to develop it because we're short on time, but that's a point that we've made a lot here at Stand to Reason. And so you don't want to let them pull the tolerance trick on you. You want to show them that this is not a good definition of tolerance. That's the new definition. The old definition of tolerance, the classical definition, is not that all ideas are equally valid, but rather that all human beings are equally valuable.
Okay.
So tolerance requires that we treat human beings with respect. It doesn't require that we affirm what they do.
Okay.
Okay, and this is why the other guys are going to, say you're wrong. Well, that's okay as long as they treat you with respect.
Right. And I've been reading some of your stuff on that too, and I like the discrimination idea. Like, yes, I think our society should discriminate against things like homosexuality.
Well, we do discriminate. There's no question about that. And the question is, what discriminations are defensible?
Right.
And so that, and I, you know, I'm going to make this point tomorrow too on my own, what I do. So, but then you have to be careful how to cash this out. You know, why is it okay to discriminate in these circumstances? Now you have to look at the individual circumstances. You know, whether it's gays in the military or homosexual marriage or whatever, and you have to be able to explain that. You know, not just toss the discrimination thing out there. Because if you just throw it out there and you don't carefully explain why these are legitimate distinctions that are being made,
right,
then they can jump on you.
And that's kind of where I'm, like, hesitant about that.
Yeah. Well, really. You know, at this late in the game, you don't want to go out on a limb on this. You know, I would do what you're doing, like the factual stuff. I think it's fair to say, you know, there seems to be a problem with homosexuality. There seems to be something wrong. Let me ask you a question. If a person was blind, that his eyes did not work, and his eyes were made for seeing but couldn't see, what would you say? Would you say that person had something wrong with them? I think so. Yeah, if they had ears for hearing, but they couldn't use their ears for hearing, would you say that was something amiss? Okay, what about a person who is given a penis by nature, but is dispositionally incapable of using that penis for what nature gave that penis for, which is to reproduce?
Right.
Now, if you're dispositionally incapable of doing it, you can't use it for what it was intended. So doesn't that strike you as odd?
Yeah.
Now, this is a strong line of argument, but I think it's a good one if placed the way that is. Because we could say at very least we've got to say something's odd here. Now, some people say, well, they're naturally homosexual in their desires, then why did nature not give you the right body for your desires?
Right.
You know, and so I'd use that to introduce, look at, so there are people, and this would be my very modest goal here. I would use this speech to show that homosexuality is questionable on health grounds alone. And secondly, there is good reason for people to raise a good faith concern about the propriety of homosexuality, considering this point that I just made. Notice I'm not even using moral language at this time. I'm not using any God or religious language at this time.
Right.
I'm just simply saying, well, look it. But we don't have the freedom to even talk about this.
Yeah.
And I would go for that. Why? Because there's so much pressure on politically correct issues that the minute you start even raising these issues, you're shouted down. That's not appropriate. And you might end with that kind of idea just to take away from them the attack that they might level at you after you're done.
Okay.
Does that sound helpful?
Yeah, that is. Thank you very much.
One last thing. Jot this website down. N-A-R-T-H. NARTH. Tell me when you got it. N-A-R-T-H. NARTH.org.
Okay.
NARTH.org. And you're going to find some primary source documentation that argues about the idea that there is no gay gene. And you want to look at the material by LeVay. He's a L-E-V-A-Y, I think. He is a homosexual researcher, did some research on the hypothalamus, and he's the one everybody points to as showing that there was a gay gene. And LeVay states there, and the original quote is on that website. He says, I have not found a gay gene. Homosexuality is not innate in that sense, and people misunderstand my views all the time. So here is the man himself who is a homosexual who's disavowing the use of his material for that. And it's good for you to have that because people are going to say, well, it's innate. They were born that way, and therefore you don't have any objections.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you very much.
Okay, Justin, keep up the good work. Let me know how it turns out. Let's go here to Gretchen. We got you, Gretchen.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind today?
Okay, I'll cut to the chase here.
Thank you.
There's a passage that has troubled me for a while here, and it's one of two passages that are really troubling. One of them, I know where it's located, and that's in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 14. And I'll just read it just real quick. It says, and it shall be, if you have no delight in her, speaking of your new wife, then you shall set her free, but you certainly shall not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally because mm-hmm. you have humbled her. And it's just like one of those odd marriage passages that it's kind of like if you don't have delight in her, you can send her away.
Mm-hmm.
It's just troubling in that I'm trying to even reconcile that with other parts of Scripture.
And yeah, you know what?
Definite thought on that.
You know, and I'm going to have to apologize because I don't think I can give you a good answer right now.
Okay.
I don't even know how to respond. There are a number of things like that in the Hebrew scriptures that just seem strange, all
okay.
right?
I can probably pick out another one about the slavery, about if you own...
Yeah, I think it's going to fall in the same category.
Okay. So basically, you just don't know?
I just don't know how to respond to that. Now, there are a number of things that I don't have an answer for yet.
Okay.
I haven't had a chance to research, and there might be others that... I would do this. I would go to answers.org, mm-hmm. answers.org.
Okay.
This is Gretchen Passantino's website,
okay.
Her husband, the late Bob Passantino. And Gretchen and Bob have amassed a very impressive amount of information there on a wide variety of topics. And
okay.
I wouldn't, yeah, answers.org. And
nice.
Drop them an email if you search and you can't find what you need and say, do you have any information about this? And they'll direct you to something.
How do you handle passages when you come across them personally in your own for your own faith, right?
Yeah.
You use scripture to edify you and to build you up and to
right.
help
and
you to
what do I do in a situation like this?
Yeah, what do you do? Like you're
thing,
like, oh, this is the God I serve.
Yeah, this is
I don't want to be rude or anything.
Yes, I understand. But here's the response. The things I know about God to be true help me carry me through the things that I'm uncertain about.
All right.
Man, I don't know what this is about. But
okay.
I have good reason to believe that God has morally sufficient reasons for doing what he does.
Okay.
And so that carries me through on the doubtful stuff. All right?
Okay.
Fair enough?
Thank you.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Let's go to Stu. Stu, welcome to Stand to Reason. How are you?
Hey, buddy. How's it going?
Good.
In Matthew 11, verse 20 through 24.
Oh, you're calling from New York, huh?
Okay. Yes.
Matthew 11, 24. Okay.
Oh, Matthew 11, verse 20.
Oh, Matthew 11, 20. Okay, let me look quickly. Why don't you tell me about it as I turn to it?
Okay, Jesus pronounces woes on Chorazin, Bethsaida,
yes.
and Capernaum,
yes.
Cities where he performed most of his miracles.
Right.
And I certainly understand the principle where he says that it'll be more bearable,
more tolerable, right.
in Sidon
right.
than for you. But what I don't understand is he also says, you know, if those miracles had been performed in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like an explicit, you know, teaching to like a Calvinist point of view, almost in the sense that Jesus is just saying, I chose not to do miracles in Tyre and Sidon.
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. And here I get hit with two in a row that you know I don't know that I got good responses to. This may be a circumstance where you see. Jesus is not speaking in a straightforward fashion here. He's speaking hyperbolically.
Right.
He's speaking in hyperbole as opposed to identifying counterfactuals, things that could have been so but aren't.
It seems like he's generalizing on the people.
Well, it almost sounds like they could have been saved if I would have done these things, but I didn't do these things, so now they're not saved. And so it almost makes God responsible for their lack of repentance. Is that the way you take it?
I mean, that's the way it
sounds.
That's the way I struggle with it, but
yeah.
I don't take it that way. I mean, I take it that, well, they didn't repent, and that's their problem.
Yeah, I think that could be taken that way. It might be the case that God says, look, if I would have done X, Y, and Z, then it would have had a certain impact on them, and I chose not to do that.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that they're not guilty for the crimes they committed.
Right.
They are still responsible because they didn't respond to the revelation that has been given to them, and therefore they are properly culpable, even though he might have been able to do more to rescue them. And I think it's up to God to decide whether he wants to do more or not. And the key thing is whether or not they were guilty of crimes against God. His grace is something that he can give to whoever he wants. Stu in New York, I got to cut it off here. We're at the end of the show. Thank you for the call. I'm glad we were able to get you in there, although maybe you got a little short shrift on the answer. That's all the time we have for this this hour, friends. Listen, tomorrow, MTV, a videotaping, so please pray for me from about 4 until 7 in the evening, and then I'll tell you next week how it went. In the meantime, you go out and give them heaven this week, all right, friends? Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.